South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning and welcome to the third and final day of our March term down here at the School of Law. The court would like to welcome West Floyd High School once again. You must have liked it so much yesterday you came back for a second day. That's great. If you've not had a chance to do so, we do have written narratives of the three oral arguments we're going to hear this morning, a brief synopsis of them. They're in the lobby. You can help yourself. And we also have a photographic history of the South Dakota Supreme Court, also available in the lobby. The first case for oral argument this morning is Dennis Linsko and others appellants versus Les Linsko and others appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons and Ms. Pamela Baldwin, attorneys from Sioux Falls. And Mr. Parsons, I understand you'll be presenting this morning. Very well. And for the appellees, we have Mr. John Burke, an attorney from Rapid City. With that, Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, and Mr. Burke. This is a breach of contract case and a fraud and deceit case that was thrown out by the trial court on summary judgment based upon the resolution of questions of law as the trial court viewed them. The standard of review for this court is de novo on both claims without a particle or a whisper of deference to the trial court's decision below. And to the extent that any facts are material to this court's decision, they have to be viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, Dennis Linsko. The facts and issues in this case can be summarized in just a minute or two. Dennis Linsko and Les Linsko are cousins, and they were partners in a farm implement business in Isabel and Mobridge for many years. They had a New Holland dealership with a five-county territory, which was Campbell, Corson, Dewey, Walworth, and Zybeck counties, which is God's country up in north-central South Dakota. And they sold balers and tractors and rakes and that type of thing. But for everything, there's a season, and all things must end. And so eventually, these partners agreed to separate pursuant to a dissolution agreement. And Dennis, the plaintiff, ended up buying the business, which was called Automotive Company, Inc., and the real estate that they jointly owned from Les. And it's undisputed that the sale of the business included the company's goodwill, accumulated over about 25 years in these counties, and particularly in Isabel and Mobridge. So what is goodwill? Well, it's not, of course, good feelings and best wishes. But it's a property right under South Dakota law, and it's defined as the element of value in a business arising from an established and longstanding relationship with customers in the surrounding area and the legitimate expectation that that will continue. So essentially, it's a customer base. And so the issues in this case then are these. Does a covenant in the agreement, in the contract between the parties, prohibiting the selling partner from engaging in any form of conduct that would harm the other party's goodwill or commercial interests, prohibit the selling partner from immediately establishing a similar business in the same communities to directly compete with his old business and solicit his former customers?
The provision actually, though, talked about the seller and the buyer.
That's true. One of the bases for the trial court's decision was that it said, well, this provision is mutual. It says, and I'll just read it, it says, the seller and buyer agree that they shall not hereinafter engage in any form of conduct or make any statements or representations that will disparage or otherwise harm the reputation, goodwill, or commercial interests of the other party. Now, the mutuality requirement is necessary and was placed in there for the disparagement section of that clause, because obviously Les and Dennis were agreeing that they weren't going to disparage each other. So there's
just kind of it's different than normal when you have a seller and a buyer and you're protecting the business that's being sold. Well, this is a little different, though.
It's a little different, but the mutuality has its effect because it prohibits disparagement mutually. But the second part of the section, which prohibits engaging in any form of conduct that harms goodwill or commercial interests, that clearly, under any reasonable interpretation of the contract, applies to the object of the contract. I mean, if 10 years from now, Dennis or Les buys a circus or starts an NFL team, no one can raise this contract as a defense and say you can't harm the commercial interests of some other business. It has to do with the object of this contract, which is the business that Dennis purchased from Les. And so that part of the section primarily inures to the plaintiff, Dennis Linsko.
Is there any testimony or by affidavit or whatever in this proceeding by the attorney that drafted this as to what he thought the clause meant?
No. No, there is none in the record.
What about negotiations concerning non-competition? Anything like that?
The record is silent as to negotiations other than Les Linsko testified that he knew that he was going to start this competing business, and he declined or did not disclose that intentionally.
You know, the having practiced, you know, and doing, you know, business deals, you know that their commercial companies sell these legal checklists for business sales and things like that, and so, you know, careful lawyers go through and these checklists and go look through these issues. Any evidence about, you know, your client discussing with his attorney these possible problems or issues?
There's no evidence in the record, and of course we weren't the counsel who represented the clients at that point.
I'm sorry. I know that it was a different attorney represented your client then.
But this clause is really better than a non-compete clause because it's broader than a non-compete clause. It does prohibit disparagement, but then it prohibits any conduct. And perhaps it's best just to...
Okay, but this was a stock sale agreement, not an asset agreement, as I understand it correctly.
Stock sale agreement and real estate.
All right. Was there any... I didn't see anything in the record that valued the goodwill as a separate item of sale, as is normally done under 5398, when there's, it talks about the sale of goodwill and the goodwill as an asset?
There's not a provision other than the provision we're litigating.
All right. Was there anything about how the valuation of the corporate stock, was that, just looking at what was in there, it looked like it was roughly assets. I didn't see a separate valuation of goodwill in coming up with a stock value either, was
there? Not in the record, and I'm not aware of any, but the sale of goodwill is incorporated, and it's as a matter of law, it's included in the sale of a business, unless it's somehow disclaimed, which I don't know how anyone would do that. South Dakota case law has made clear that when you purchase a business, you're purchasing its goodwill. But no, there was no separate itemization of that. And the record doesn't contain the thoughts of the attorneys involved.
Back to mutuality. You know, I'm having trouble making sense out of the fact that you're asking us to infer from this language a covenant not to compete. And yet, it doesn't make sense that one of these parties could not compete, could not engage in this business. Yet the clause applies to both.
But as I said, the clause involves a broad range of conduct, and perhaps
But then how do you infer a mutual covenant not to compete? That doesn't make sense.
Well, not every part of Section 4.1 has to be precisely mutual. Is my point. I think. I mean, the disparagement clause would be certainly interpreted as mutual. Each party could not do things to harm each other's commercial and business interests that are the subject of this agreement, certainly. But since the goodwill and commercial interests, there's only one business that those attach to. So a reasonable person reading this contract could not attach goodwill and commercial business and interests to anything other than the business that is the subject of this sale. And so that part of the phrase of the clause is the primary beneficiary is the plaintiff, Dennis, on that. And I think that would be understood by any two businessmen who are selling a business, one to the other. I mean, the goodwill and commercial interests, whose right are those? It's the purchasers. It's not the sellers. So it's an unreasonable interpretation of the contract to conclude that Les's goodwill and commercial interests here are being protected. That part of is not mutual.
One more unrelated question. Would you agree that in normal business transactions, you normally see these two clauses as separate provisions in contracts, in business contracts? There's usually a disparagement clause and a non-compete clause, and they're usually separate paragraphs or sections of the agreement.
They are. Okay. They are usual, although, you know, that doesn't mean it has to be that way. And the lawyers here, both lawyers, two attorneys on this for each side, drafted the contract this way. And you have to give meaning to each part of the clause. You can't just say, well, it's just a disparagement clause. It does have two elements. And one is very broad, and it was very broad because there are a lot of ways that you can hurt a business after you sold it. But the primary way is to immediately set up right next door and start competing. And that's covered by this language. So we can't change the language. The court's left with this language. But it has to give effect to it, you know, as it under the rules of interpretation. And it's so, I mean, it says there's a prohibition against future conduct. You cannot engage in any form of conduct. So you can't do anything or make any statements or representations. So that's separate. You can't say anything that will disparage or otherwise harm the reputation or the goodwill or the commercial interests of the other party. Now, setting up shop next door and saying, I'm going to sell the same implements to the same people I've been selling them in Isabel, selling them to in Isabel and Mobridge and these five counties, that directly harms the asset that he just sold for $1.4 million. He knows it does. Anyone knows that it will and does. And there's no way to make that conduct not fit under harming goodwill and commercial interests. Goodwill is a customer base. Your commercial interests are your business. If you're competing for the same customers, trying to sell them the same tractors and balers, you're harming that business. And so this clause should not be punished because it gives too much protection to the plaintiff. I mean, there may have been an overreach here, but it's not an overreach that voids the provision. It's one that this court can reform or can remand and have the trial court reform to fit a specified geographical area as covenants usually
do.
How
would we do that? We would, because by statute, non-compete is has temporal and spatial limitations. So you're saying either we would have to create these limitations or the trial court would. How would we do that when we have no evidence of what the negotiations were between the parties?
Well, that's why I think that would have to be best be remanded to the trial court. I mean, you would have a trial about that. This court has many times reformed covenants not to compete. I think the time space is in the statute. It's so long as the seller carries on a like business within the specified geographical area. But we need a trial, and we need a fact finder in this case is what we need. That's your point, I think.
But you know the difference here is we've blue-lined in our cases before provisions that violate the restraints and trade provisions. But here we would have to create all of them because none of those provisions are in this agreement.
Well, I'd say they're covered. They're incorporated by the otherwise harm language, any form of conduct that harms. And so all the court would have to say is, well, that obviously includes, any conduct includes direct competition in the same communities. And the only thing the court would have to do, as it does in other cases, is say, well, the specified geographical area should be either Isabel and Mobridge or the five counties that constituted their territory. And that's all, because then the duration is governed by the statute. So it's really just the same as these other cases.
But how do we know that they would have negotiated a contract for the maximum time period? They could have negotiated something less than the maximum time.
And you know, that's always not known when a time period is not specified in a covenant not to compete. And this court has dealt with that, and the trier of fact ultimately would.
All right. When you just talked about the area and the area covered by their contract, there were other lines other than New Holland was the primary one that was mentioned in the brief, but they are only one of reading between the lines, that the implication was there was more lines than just New Holland. That was
Vermeer Rakes. Yeah.
So why would we tie it to what a New Holland dealership would be rather than some other tie?
And I think we need evidence on that issue. I would agree. That's our suggestion. That was our suggestion up front. The trial court never reached that question because of its interpretation of the contract on the barrier issue. So that we would need evidence on that. But ultimately, a finder of fact has to make that type of determination.
So are you asking us to send this back for fact-finding?
Well, for a trial, and in conjunction with that, the scope of the territory would have to be determined. Because the trial court never reached that issue. The trial court just said, well, I don't think there's a covenant not to compete, and that's it, just in an oral decision, no law cited or anything, just a...
Well, you've asked for us to reform the contract.
Yes.
That the pleadings that you presented to the trial court?
I believe so, yes. Yes.
How do you distinguish public opinion publishing? Because, you know, in that case we said that we do not infer a covenant in restraint of trade from the sale of a business and its goodwill. And it seems to me that's exactly what you're asking us to do here today.
I would say not. That's the first case we cited was a public opinion case. You don't infer it when there's no language supporting it. But here we're not asking the court to infer a covenant not to compete. We're asking the court to recognize that the language in the contract that the parties agreed upon includes that prohibition. So it's not an inference. It's a deduction from the plain language. And it's not something from nothing. It is something from something.
If I can't read it, then I've got to infer it, don't I?
Well, no. This is how I thought of it. If you wanted to enter a contract with somebody not to physically harm you, there's two ways you could do it, and both would be perfectly valid. You could say, all right, you can't punch me in the nose. You can't kick me in the stomach. You can't pull my hair. You can't poke my eyes out. Or you could say, you can't engage in any conduct that would harm me. And that's exactly what happened here. That's what the plain language of this contract says. And to write out, as the trial court did, write out things that are included in that, saying, well, I don't think that should fall under that prohibition, it puts its contract interpretation in reverse. I mean, you have the court reading out elements that are covered by a very intentionally broad term. And the trial court basically said, well, otherwise harm. Well, that could mean that Les can't blare speakers in his car and drive around the store to chase customers away. That's not disparagement, but that's conduct that could harm. And maybe that's what it must have meant. But his analysis entirely begs the point, because of course it could mean that, but it could mean 100 other things. And that's why you needed a broad prohibition. And the main thing that it prohibits is competition, because that's the main way, the most common way, that you can harm the goodwill customer base of a business that you've just sold. So we're simply asking, now, after the contract's been interpreted, the second level to this is then whether it was breached. That's a question of fact for the jury to determine. So this court interprets the contract, tells us what it means, and then whether or not it was breached, that's for a jury to decide under this court's clear case law. I do want to get to the, I'm not sure where my time is, but I do want to get to the fraud.
You got 2 minutes.
Okay. I think the fraud and deceit is just as strong in this case, because the record demonstrates that when Les Linscope took a pen in his hand and signed his name for the bottom of this contract, and took a check for $1.4 million. He knew he was going to open up businesses to sell the same implements to the same customers. He knew it. He was going to do it. It was his plan. The definition of deceit, and it's we take you through it in our brief, but it's clear under the restatement section 551 2E that a partner to a party to a business transaction is under duty to use reasonable care to disclose facts basic to the transaction. Where, and I'm omitting some of the language, but where you'd reasonably expect a disclosure of those facts under the circumstances.
That takes us right to the nub of it, because the question here, was there a duty to disclose his intent? I think that's what it's going to come down to. In this case, what struck me was this case started out as an involuntary dissolution action. And I'm having trouble seeing, if I'm in an adversary position with the other side, because I've brought an action to dissolve involuntarily, I don't see a duty there when there's an adversary relationship to dissolve the corporation.
But the duty is imposed by the restatement if you know there are facts that are basic to the transaction. And nothing is more intrinsic to the sale of goodwill than whether or not there's going to be competition for those same customers. That's under the cases we've cited.
Didn't the parties have an opportunity to protect themselves? They were both represented by counsel, and they could have protected themselves in their negotiated language.
Well, and we suggest they did in Section 4.1, but if he knows I'm going to set up business and that's my intention, that is a fact basic to the transaction that a partner would expect his disillusioning partner or his disillusioned partner to disclose to the other. And the most important thing is all these, you see reasonable care, reasonable disclosure, all these are fact questions. It was completely inappropriate for this to be resolved on summary judgment. A jury needs to decide whether this was a fact basic to the transaction under this court's case, and maybe.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Burke, you have 20 minutes.
Chief Justice Gilbertson, members of the court, Mr. Parsons, thank you for allowing me to argue today. Let's be clear at the outset about what the appellants, what Dennis is asking this court to do. The clause states, the non-disparagement clause, as it's captioned, states seller and buyer agree that they shall not hereinafter engage in any form of conduct or make any statements or representations that will disparage or otherwise harm the reputation, goodwill, or commercial interest of the other party. Now, if you read the appellant's brief, this is what they want this court to turn that language into. Quote, Les Lenzko is prohibited from carrying on a similar business in Corson, Dewey, Walworth, Zeebach, and Campbell counties as long as Dennis Lenzko operates the automotive company incorporated in those counties. That's what this court is being asked to do in this case. Now, Mr. Parsons wisely uses the more innocuous term of reform or revise. But in the end, this court's not being asked to reform the non-disparagement clause. It's being asked to draft a non-compete. It's not being asked to revise a clause. It's actually being asked to craft a non-compete. This court has to come up with something entirely different than from what's in the party's agreement. And if the court will review the dissolution agreement, you'll find that it's several pages. And nowhere in there do you find the basic terms that are required to form a covenant not to compete in connection with the sale of goodwill. There are a couple facts that I want to touch upon that Mr. Parsons did not get into, but that were alluded to a little bit by some of the questions with the court. The context of this agreement should not be lost upon the court. In the spring of 2005, after they had been in business for many years, the parties' relationship became strained, and at some point, they actually wrote to New Holland, the main franchise, and asked if they could split the franchise, where one of them would take Mulbridge and one would take Isabel. New Holland declined. The relationship gets further strained to the point where Les actually files a dissolution action, files a lawsuit seeking to dissolve the corporation. He simply wants to be away from Dennis Lunsko. Both parties are represented by counsel. They're in the context of this action. They don't get along. And we're approaching a half a year into this dissolution action when they enter into this dissolution agreement. You will not find the words competition, compete, carrying on a similar business, anything like that in this agreement. What the appellant is essentially asking the court to do requires a number of leaps. First of all, you would have to conclude that somewhere within this non-disparagement clause, somewhere cloaked within this language, is apparently a covenant not to compete. That's the first decision you'd have to make, is that in Mr. Parsons' word, it's overly broad, but it's a covenant not to compete. The next step this court would then have to do is it would recognize that by statute, STCL 53-9-8, agreements in restraint of trade are void. So then this court would next have to decide whether one of the statutory exceptions, one of the four that are laid out by the legislature, apply in this case. The only one that is arguably applicable and the appellants rely upon is 53-9-9 in connection with the sale of goodwill. Some of the questions about the sale of goodwill were very fitting by this court. It wasn't separately delineated. But what we have done for purposes of in front of the trial court for summary judgment and here now, we're simply going to work under the premise, just assume that it's there, and go ahead and analyze the covenant under 53-9-9.
So you're assuming that there's a sale of goodwill? You want us to assume that? Is that what you're saying today?
We were for purposes of summary judgment. What I will represent to the court is you won't find it in the sale of shares. And I know that the opposing counsel repeatedly refers to this as the sale of a business, but actually one of the parties bought out the other party's shares in the corporation along with some real estate. So if you look at 53-9-9, there are three parameters. This court has said in Franklin versus Forever Venture, there are three statutory parameters that must be met. You need to have something talking about the other party not carrying on a like business. You need to have some sort of geographical limitation, and you need to talk about how long it's going to last. In this case, you will find none of those three. You won't find any of them. And so,
where is the otherwise harm clause in there? Are you saying that your client's competing business with the same products is not harming the business of the plaintiff? In the sale of the products?
I would say any time you have a competitor out there, I suppose if they get a customer that you don't, it is harming your business in some fashion, but I don't know that it's improper harm and not in breach of a non-disparagement clause.
How do you distinguish, then, this language that says your client will not otherwise harm the business of his brother?
I would submit, Your Honor, as the trial court, actually, Judge Porcher came up with some very good examples on his own that otherwise harm more or less modifies disparage, because if you literally say one word, disparage, maybe the person does something that doesn't, in their opinion, fall within the definition. But the focus of the clause is to avoid bad-mouthing by the parties against one another. It is a non-disparagement clause. That was obviously a concern of the parties. And I suppose, you know, what constitutes disparagement, but when you add or otherwise harm, it's essentially of that ilk. It is saying even if a clever lawyer could say that your conduct, quote, was not disparagement, was it of the same nature? Were you attempting to hurt this guy by improper means? That's the sort of things we're looking at.
But the actual language is disparage or otherwise harm.
Correct, Your Honor.
That suggests two different things.
Well, if the otherwise harm is something close to disparage but not identical, it would be or that. I'm not sure which of the justices asked the question, and I think it was you, Justice Dinner. They are typically different clauses. And if you look at the cases, that opposing counsel cites. In his brief, he says that this court has essentially had a longstanding policy of reforming covenants not to compete. He cites Justice Meyer-Henry's case in Franklin versus Forever Venture. But if you read the clauses in Forever Venture, Simpson versus C&R Supply, Justice Konenkamp, Ward versus Mincom, Lesher versus Palicki, if you look at those cases, the clause that they're talking about actually looked, sounded, felt like a covenant not to compete. People were talking about geographical areas. People were talking about what the leaving party could or could not do. In this case, there's nothing like that. I also think it's important, and some of the questions got into it, the mutuality here is, I think, important. If you take their literal definition or literal interpretation that they're using, that this is a covenant not to compete, then it essentially means that Dennis also can't compete, I guess, in the farm implement business or however they're defining it, because it went both ways. When we step back and look at the plain language, it doesn't look like a covenant not to compete. It doesn't have any of the three parameters. And they're asking this court to essentially something I would liken to like a legal alchemist. They have this non-disparagement clause, but they just don't like it that much. And we want to have you change it into a nice, shiny, gold covenant not to compete. Now that we've bought Les Lynchgo out for a fixed price, now that we have the business, now we want to come back in and see if we can get a non-compete on top of it. In the end, this court has said repeatedly, it is not the function of this court to rewrite a party's agreement. There's a bargain for exchange. These two agreed to separate, go their different ways. And this is the agreement they reached. The terms are straightforward. This is not a situation like Ward, Franklin, Simpson, where they had terms that fit within 5399, but simply got a little overbroad on one or maybe left one out. There aren't any.
Is there any evidence in the record that the price for the stock and the real estate would have been higher if there had been a covenant not to compete?
I don't believe so.
Okay. So that's just your spin on it.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that I think it would be typical from the cases I've seen that when a covenant not to compete is demanded, and Les Lynchgo was going to have to make the decision to leave the business his dad started and not be able to do it with his four sons, something he's done his whole life, that essentially that it wouldn't be typical for sellers to require more to walk away from what they've done.
All right. From where we have this case, that we're looking at it, we don't have any idea of what was included in the valuation of the stock, do we? I mean, we don't know if it's actually a value that's what the real estate was, what the real estate and parts would be, if there's blue sky involved, if there's goodwill. We have no idea as to any of that.
That's exactly right.
So it could be actually a sale below book value.
It could be. But what we have is what we know is what we have, which is a several-page agreement that was the product of negotiations represented by counsel where the parties agreed to certain language. And this court looks at the four corners of that document to interpret it from its plain language and say, you know, what is this? Because we need to keep in mind that the prohibition on covenants and restrained trade is a broad public policy that the legislature has come up with, this court has enforced, and this court has said on more than one occasion that it will look at exceptions to that very narrowly, because they don't like covenants and restraint of trade. And so we're being asked to take a non-disparagement clause and essentially extract terms from it and then recombine them to come up with a three-part covenant not to compete that is specific to what Les Lynchgo cannot do, specific to countings, and specific for how long, even though none of that was addressed by the parties in the agreement. Now,
can we talk a little bit about, before your time runs out, about the other action, the fraud, deceit action? Because, you know, it strikes me that while your client is negotiating the sale of the dealership, he's furtively negotiating getting another dealership to compete. Why is that not deceit here?
Well, there's a few reasons, Your Honor, but in the end, The appellant has not argued, when we look at whether there's a duty to disclose in an arm's-length transaction, the appellant here hasn't argued that there was a fiduciary duty or a duty because of some employer-employee relationship. This court laid this out in Schwartz versus Morgan and said, quote, historically, this court has never imposed a duty to disclose information on parties to an arm's-length transaction absent an employment or fiduciary duty. But then the court went on to recognize that it has recognized a duty under Restatement Section 551 for facts basic to the transaction, but it's not simply is it a fact that's basic to the transaction. It's if he knows that the other party is about to enter into it under a mistake, and because of the relationship between them, the customs of the trade, or other objective circumstances, he would reasonably expect a disclosure of those facts. And so where I'm sitting is I'm saying, we're in a dissolution action. We tried writing one of the main franchises to see if we could separate. That clearly gives some idea that there might be an interest on both sides to go into business. They write to actually ask, can we separate these stores? That should give some idea. The record will show that there were negotiations back and forth. There were numbers exchanged where Les would buy Dennis's shares out, numbers where Dennis would buy Les out. The notion that someone could say, I didn't have any idea that Les Lensko might want to be in the farm implement business when he jointly wrote to New Holland to see if they could split the stores, when he offered to buy you out.
You know, that argument, that's a persuasive argument, but it sounds more like an argument you'd make to a jury than to a court deciding summary judgment. You're asking us to say as a matter of law, as a matter of law, there's no deceit here.
Yes, and here's why. It has to be a fact basic to the transaction. And I would submit that this isn't a situation where you have, for example, I gave the illustration in my brief that if Les owned certain of the property that was sold here, if he represented in the deal, I own this property, and he really didn't own it, the property is a fact that's basic to the transaction. You can buy another person's shares in a corporation or buy out one of four partners, and they may compete or they may not compete. Depends on what they want to do, but it's not the fundamental component of the transaction. It, before you get to the jury question, because the appellant simply saying this is a fact that's basic to the transaction doesn't make it so. This court has to decide, is there that underlying duty in light of, first of all, they have to create an issue of fact. We have to keep that in mind. In their brief, I actually submitted in our in Appellee's brief that they didn't really address the second and third elements of 551, and I would submit that they waived them. They need to create an issue of fact saying that Les knew. They need to create an issue of fact that Les knew that Dennis was about to enter into that mistake. Their argument in their brief is that Dennis reasonably believed that Les would not get into business. What Dennis reasonably believed is not what Les knew. That doesn't create an issue of fact about what Les knew.
But you know, if I'm going to write a check to somebody for $1.4 million, I think it'd be pretty important to know that they're going to set up shop next door the next day.
I agree, Your Honor. In fact, I don't have the quote, but it's in actually the appellant's brief, and Judge Porcher worded it pretty well. He said something to the effect of, had I been Dennis Lensko, I would have wanted a non-compete. Would I like to have had one? I would have liked to have had one, but did he ask for one? No. It might be something you want to know. It might be something that you specifically require, that you negotiate for, or that you actually refer to in the agreement. I would submit this, and I don't know how much time I have left, so I would look at it like this, Your Honor. Let's assume that opposing counsel is correct, that this non-compete is the most fundamental thing to this whole agreement. Let's assume that for a minute. Wouldn't you want to talk about it in the dissolution agreement? It's 9 or 10 pages long, gets into very specific things, very narrow issues, but nobody bothered to say, even though the appellant says this is most basic, nobody bothered to say, Les Lensko, and by the way, they can say it very well now. It's in their brief multiple times. Les Lensko, they're asking this court to write it. One simple sentence. Les Lensko can't operate a farm implement business in Corson, Dewey, Zeebach, several counties, as long as Dennis owns the automotive. If that was the fact that was most fundamental, Dennis or his counsel or somewhere along the line, or maybe the checklist that Justice Konenkamp alluded to earlier, maybe they would have included it. It's not in the agreement. This court is being placed in the awkward position now of having to essentially make a few leaps and change one end of the deal. The appellant is asking simply, let's have a trial to see if we can have a non-compete and whether or not that should be, what the terms of it should be. What about the other terms? This court can't be in the business of going into intricate paragraphs of a contract and rewriting the contract. This court has said that's not its job. And this court actually has said that...
Minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court has added that when discussing that it doesn't have a duty to rewrite parties' agreements, that it's important that the parties were represented by counsel during the process. That's something this court finds relevant. The only other thing I want to touch upon before I end is, where does this go? The fraud count, where does this go? If you have a small veterinarian practice, three partners, and one of them maybe sits down with a competitor over dinner and says, you know what, I get along with you better. Maybe I'd like to join you down the road. And then he goes back and he sells out his interest in the corporation. But he doesn't specifically say, I'm going to go compete. I'm going to go with someone else. And they have a several-page agreement and it's left out. Is he committing fraud? Is having dinner with the competitor to perhaps start a different venture, go a different route, is that fraud now? Is that deceit? The question seems like if it was that important, it should have been addressed in the contract. And how far does the duty go? If it is fraud, does the person then, if you're thinking about selling out, saying, I'm going to tell you I'm going to be competing in this town, do they have to say what towns, what counties? If it's a lingering thought, maybe you retire. You know, maybe they're going to retire from the business of being a vet in Hewlett, Wyoming, and then they decide, a couple years later, I want to be in it again. Was a lingering thought that you might get in the business down the road, is that fraud? Do you have to be specific about who you're joining, when you're joining? Where this could go, by simply saying there's always an issue of fact, as the appellant would have it, because I felt it was a fact basic to the transaction, means that in their mind, this would always be a jury question. You'd always simply go to the jury, and he had a duty to tell me. Well, wait a minute. It's not simply is it a fact that's basic to the transaction. You have to also create an issue of fact showing, is it something that the other party knew that I was mistaken about? Was it reasonable for me to think objectively that he should have an obligation to tell me? Schwartz versus Morgan, is it something I couldn't have reasonably discovered on my own? In your end, Your Honors, I would ask that Judge Porter's decision be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'm less concerned with the runaway jury argument. I think juries are smart, and they deal with these types of issues all the time. What I'm concerned about is where we go with an interpretation of a contract where courts take broad prohibitions in a contract that both parties agree to and then redline out included particulars that fall within that broad prohibition. I'm concerned with the trial court saying, I know he agreed, he had a lawyer and he agreed not to engage in any form of conduct that harms Dennis's goodwill and commercial interests, but I'm crossing out competition from that broad prohibition. That's what concerns me about this court's decision if it declines to give force to the otherwise harm language in this contract. This clause is better than a non-compete clause. If we had to do over again, we probably would draft it differently. Given where we are today, we certainly would have. But we're stuck with the language that we have. And the language that we have prohibits what Dennis Linscov did. At least it can be interpreted to prohibit that. And a jury should decide whether his conduct breached those provisions. That's a fact question. To say that otherwise harm modifies disparage goes against all of this court's rules of contractual interpretation. They're two separate things, And to adopt the trial court's interpretation writes one of those out of this contract. On the fraud claim, the Fifth Circuit said, and we cited this case in our brief, it is unfair and tantamount to fraud to sell a business with one hand and attempt to recapture its fruit with another. And this court echoed that same sentiment in the Franklin case. When the goodwill of a business is sold, it would be unfair for the seller to engage in competition which diminishes the value of the asset he sold. That's from the Franklin case. In other words, goodwill and non-competition from the seller are implicitly interrelated in that the former is dependent in many ways upon the latter. The Nebraska Supreme Court's case, it says the buyer's interest in what he has acquired cannot be effectively realized unless the seller engages not to act so as to unreasonably diminish the value of what has been sold. So my point with this is, of course, it's something that is basic to a transaction where you're selling a business. And it's the same whether you're selling your shares in your business or selling a business from one to the other. It was partners that were no longer going to be doing business together, and one took over the business. But that fact is basic to the transaction. It's something you would want to know. And it's a jury question as to whether he should have known, whether he would reasonably expect that to be disclosed, whether that's something that was, under all the circumstances and all the evidence, something that he had a duty to disclose. It's a reasonable care standard, as the restatement provides. And the court didn't look at any facts. It simply basically said in its oral decision on this, well, I've found that the contract does not include a covenant not to compete, so then accordingly there must not be a duty to disclose. That's basically what it was, about a paragraph read into the record.
Well,
so
how do you deal with the South Dakota policy that contracts and restraint of trade are void? That's where we have to start with under our analysis of this.
That's right. Well, you start with the broad contract language, and we're on the breach of contract question. You start with the broad contract language, and then what does the statute do to that? Well, there's a broad prohibition against restraints of trade, and then 5399 says except when there's a sale of goodwill in a business, and that's assumed in any sale of a business that the goodwill is part of that, whether it's delineated or not. And that then, if it's too broad, if it's not limited geographically or as to time, then those can be added to the prohibition that's there. And so that's how this court has always dealt with these. So really this case is nothing new under the sun. But back to the deceit question, everything in the test is for a jury to determine after it's heard all of the evidence. And Les Linskov doesn't want this case to get anywhere near a jury. And I don't blame him, because he knows exactly what he did. And that's my interpretation of the facts in the light most favorable to my client. And that's the interpretation of the facts that this court is supposed to adopt on appeal.
There is a high threshold. I mean, facts basic to the business. If we use the restatement, 551,
yes,
it says that it's the fact that taking advantage of the plaintiff's ignorance, that's so shocking to the ethical sense of the community and is so extreme and unfair as to amount to a form of swindling. So there is a high hurdle there to get over. And the question is, do we say as a matter of law that that's is or is not a fact?
It's not a question of law. It's a question for the jury. And then, you know, this court can always look at the evidence after it's come in and determine whether there was enough evidence to support the verdict. But Restatement Section 551.2e reads to me like a jury instruction. And all of these elements, the evidence should come in and be considered by a fact finder. I mean, this case has never had a fact finder, and that's all my client seeks. If I could just say, Justice Meyer Henry, it's been a wonderful privilege to have appeared before you during your service to the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.